Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yes. Russell and thousands of men and women all over the country are listening to the show tonight, and they are facing that question because they do want to change. They may even have the tools to change, although I truly believe that this show, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, is the show that teaches you how to change. Now, the bad news is if you aren't working the steps, if you aren't doing the work, if you aren't accessing your recovery tools, you're not going to change. And, you know, sometimes I'll deal with somebody who, for instance, is alleged to have narcissistic personality disorder. You know, one of those personality disorders that very clearly keeps somebody from being able to empathize with their environment, their community, their spouse, their kids, whatever. And if they're fighting that kind of personality issue, it makes it even tougher. And, you know, the very thing, the very personality traits that may have contributed to having a successful background in life, going far, being ambitious, getting what you want, is also the thing that could really, truly keep a person from finding recovery. Because you have to be able to understand how your actions affect others. And it can be terribly, terribly difficult if my clients don't have empathy skills. The good news is almost all of my clients do. And so I say with a lot of assuredness, if you're listening to the show, you probably are wanting extra help. And when you access the tools needed to make your life different, you will maintain recovery from sexual addiction. Hi, I'm Carol Jorgensen Sheets, and you know this is the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show. That's what they call me, Carol the Coach, and I'm going to ask you to do me a few favors. Even as you listen to this show, I want you to go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and I want you to email me questions you may have about this issue. I also want you to go to my Facebook page, and you access that by going to Carol the Coach, Sex Addiction, or you can go under my name, Carol Jorgensen Sheets, and then hit the Sex Addiction page. And I want you to like it, and here's why. I now have 146,000 downloads a week. But I don't have anybody going to my page, and I want you to go to my page because I want you to see who I'm going to be interviewing every week. I think that's so important. My authors, my workshop leaders, my treatment specialists, they all deserve that PR. You know, tonight we're going to be talking with Catherine McCall, and she wrote a book called Never Tell, a true story of overcoming a terrifying childhood. It is actually a UK bestseller, and Catherine just does a beautiful job of talking about how her life looks so idyllic and so normal. Actually, more than normal. It looks so entitled in many ways. She looked like she had it all. And there was a huge struggle, a huge dark secret in her childhood. And we all know the trauma can either create many, many problems and immobilize you from getting the life you deserve, or it can make you stronger. It can create resiliency. And that's what I want you to believe about yourself. I kid you not. I'm promising you, once you get through this sex addiction, once you manage it, once you are in recovery, you are going to be a better, stronger person because you have seen a certified sexual addiction therapist. You may have gone through Smart Recovery, or you may have gone through Recovery Nation, or you may have gone through the 12 steps. Perhaps you've been to treatment one, two, or even three times. You know, this addiction is a very cunning and baffling disease. Sometimes it takes that long before you finally get it and do the work you have to do. Now, Catherine does not have sexual addiction in her background, so when I read her book, I said, yes, I'd really like you to be on the show. I've heard a lot of great things about you. I mean, you all know I've been trained by Patrick Carnes. He endorsed her book, as did Wendy Malz, who did the sexual healing journey, as did Pat Love, who wrote Never Be Lonely Again. I mean, here's what Patrick Carnes says. He says, I know of no other memoir that details without evasion how a married couple in similar circumstances navigates through the layers of healing that are part of recovering from sexual abuse. So here are some experts in the field that say this is an amazing book to read. And Catherine herself said, how can I help people with sexual addiction? And I said, Catherine, so many of my addicts and their partners have been through physical, emotional, and most oftentimes sexual abuse. And they have to begin to heal that pain. So you can really help my listeners by sharing your story. Because when you share your story with others, they do their work that you're doing too. It's just an amazing phenomena. It's synergy at its finest. And so that's why I wanted her to be on the show. And she not only talks about the abuse, but she talks about what it was like, what it's like to be in therapy versus not being in therapy. And, you know, why that therapist relationship is so important. And then she goes into, you know, what is it like to be an adult, to have been in a marriage and have had those kind of wounds affect your relationship? And I know that probably 70% of my listening audience can relate to her. So I really wanted her to come on and talk about this. It's such an important topic. You know, when I started out in the field, I ran a treatment program for molesters and their families and the children they molested and their families. And sometimes that was all one huge paradigm. And our hope was for reconciliation to occur, to empower the children, the spouses, to practice assertiveness, to know what it's like to say no, to set boundaries. I mean, all a lot of healthy skills that we need to be teaching people. And it was a very successful program. I ran groups. I saw family. I did a lot of family therapy, and I did the individual therapy work. I loved it, and I'll tell you why. And I'm sure that work grew me for the work I'm doing right now. One of the things that I knew is that molesters typically are not monsters. You know, yes, there are some molesters that are monsters, but the majority of people who molest men and women are reenacting their trauma and with a younger child, with a family member. And it's almost like a compulsion developed early on in their psyche as a child, and they have looked for ways to continue to reenact that trauma. So I remember telling people when they go, oh, how could you work with sexual abuse? And I'd say, I work with sexual abuse because I know that I have an innate skill not to judge. And I think that is so important, to not judge. And so, clearly, now that I work with sex addicts, I believe the same thing. I believe that addicts are good people that have made poor decisions. And what I know to be true is that when they go through the work, they end up being better human beings than the majority of people out there that don't do any self-development, any personal growth. And that's the good news, that there is plenty of work that you can do to be the best person you've ever been. So I so appreciate this opportunity to talk with you, and can't wait for Catherine McCall to come on the show and talk about her memoir, Never Tell, A True Story of Overcoming a Terrifying Childhood. Now, I got to tell you, it's been an interesting week. You know, last week we interviewed Christine Turow Shields, who talked about anxiety and how that plays itself out. And after the show, I told her that she had done a good job. And she said, well, you know, I had just found out about Robin Williams' death. And to be real honest, I was really affected. I was having some trouble concentrating. I just felt like things were surreal. And I'm sure as you went through the week, you too had some opinions about his death, his suicide, his depression. They didn't call it bipolar, but he's clearly been diagnosed with bipolar, and his addiction. And you know, anybody who has bipolar depression is much more likely to become an addict because they medicate with drugs, alcohol, food, gambling, or sex. And I'm certainly not projecting that Robin Williams was an addict by any stretch of the imagination, but he had a lot of demons. And anybody who's a sex addict knows what that's like, because you too have demons. And I have had people say, I want to kill myself. My wife doesn't want me alive. She told me to go blow my brains out. I mean, just some really dark, serious things. And truly, if that is you, if you've had those feelings, know that there are people out there that can help that. Because you know what? That's a temporary feeling, and it may reoccur, but with the right therapist, probably the right pharmacology, the right readings, the right kind of programs, you can let go of some of that darkness, kind of drop that rock of resentment and move beyond it. So I really encourage anybody who faces an addiction, anybody who faces a disorder like bipolar, to know that there's help out there. That's why we have this show. And I got such a kick out of it. I got an email from a woman who said, oh, I listened to your show the next morning. It downloads on my iPod. I stick it in my car, and I really enjoy your show. And she said, it's really enlightened me about both my husband and my brother, whom are sex addicts. And so for you people out there that download the show, you know, I have very few active listens compared to the thousands, well, like I said, about 148,000 downloads each week that are actually open. I just appreciate your listenership, and keep sending me those emails at carolthecoach@aol.com, and take a look at my website, www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach. Okay, now we're going to be talking about sexual abuse, and as I just indicated, that can be a tough subject. So, Catherine McCall, welcome to Sex Help with Carol the Coach. How are you?
Thank you, Carol, and I'm very well, thanks. A little hoarse, though, so I hope
I come
through
okay. Well, that's okay. We can live with that. Tell me a little bit about, you had been recommended to me. Your book was recommended to me. Tell me what made you decide to do the show tonight.
Well, you know, as you know, I'm also a therapist, and mm-hmm. I also am a CSAT. So, you know, I know that very many sex addicts suffer with having been sexually abused in their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm, you know, quite aware that your goals in this show are really the same as my goals in writing my memoir,
mm-hmm.
because you want very much to contribute to the hope and the strength and the recovery of women and men who are struggling with deep sexual pain. And that is precisely why I was writing my memoir. I could have, you know, kept my story quiet, but I really felt compelled to, you know, bring it out into the open. I know that some people just live in the dark hole of shame and are afraid to even speak about what happened to them. I'm, you know, a very fortunate person in the fact that throughout my life, though I did experience severe abuse, I also had the experience of many fine, fine people in my life who influenced me and cared about me, and I have the advantage of an education. So, you know, I felt that I had the capacity to put my experiences into words. And when you contacted me about your show, I thought, well, I just need to say yes. So that's why I decided to do it.
Thank you so very much. And, you know, this may be a little bit uncomfortable for you because in addition to the fact that your memoir is so raw and, it really goes into detail
mm-hmm.
and you don't, there are no holds barred in this memoir. You just say it like you feel it. You talk about it the way it happened. I know that there will be, and you do too, some listeners that have actually participated in abusing. You know, they've had something called trauma reenactment where they are taking out the compulsion that occurred as they were a child from being sexually abused, and they're taking it out on another person. And whether they're in mm-hmm. recovery from that or whether they're still abusing, I want them to know there's hope, strength, and recovery too. So
mm-hmm.
I just believe this is going to ripple into a way for a lot of people to not feel ashamed and to learn what they can do no matter which side of the fence they fall on. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I do. I do. And now it brings up something that I think is important is to mention RAIN, the Rape and Incest National Network, and a hotline number they have at 1-800-656-HOPE, H-O-P-E. That's 1-800-656-8255. H-O-P-E. They have people who can, you know, help folks out who might be feeling very stirred up or in a crisis.
Well, that's fantastic, and I'll make sure to repeat that at the end of the show, too,
okay.
So that if somebody's getting a pen or pencil right now, you can feel free to know that I will be repeating that number as we wrap the show up. Now, again, as I was reading this, I thought, wow, you have a lot of courage. And you said, I could have chosen not to share the story. So tell me, why did you choose such a detailed way of presenting your experiences to the reader?
I have been aware from the time I was in therapy dealing with my own abuse and memories and whatnot. Every day I'm aware of the fact that there are so many children being abused as we speak. And I wanted people to know the amount of abuse a child can survive, how incredible that is, how awful it is that it happens to them, but how incredible that is. I wanted to really show how damage happens. So, you know, that was my conscious reason for doing that. As time has gone on, though, I believe I've had a significant unconscious reason as well, and that is to tell the whole world precisely what my father had told me to never tell anyone. I think it's kind of funny that that didn't really dawn on me until after I had written the book. But, you know, I think both those things were going on.
Absolutely.
And I
so
think
not
that
only
in,
did you... Go ahead.
Yeah, in the details also reveals the character of my father. Just for listeners, my father was the perpetrator. And, you know, I think it tells a lot about who he was and what was going on in his mind, how his mind worked.
So give the readers a little bit of the background. You know, you grew up in this upper middle class family. Your dad was a doctor. Your mom had a college degree, which wasn't necessarily typical of women in her generation. And they were both alcoholics, and your dad had this mental illness, and yet he was a doctor. So give our listeners a little bit of background as to what your childhood was like.
Okay. I was born in 1948. So, you know, my childhood was in the late 40s and 50s and early 60s. During that period of time, just in our culture, physicians had a lot of power. They had a lot of clout, a lot of status. You know, people would not think ill of anything to do with a physician. They'd do exactly what he would tell them to do, et cetera. My father was very, very bright. He was a genius, really, and he was an ophthalmologist. He was the ophthalmologist for the Brooklyn Dodgers. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. He was bipolar. He was manic depressive. I didn't know that as a child. Didn't figure that out until later. And to my knowledge, he was treated for that only once, shortly after my parents were married. He had a psychotic episode, and his colleagues admitted him to Walter Reed. He was in the Army at that time. And he was there for several months. And my mother, you know, a newlywed, frightened of mental illness, was not included in the treatment at all. In those days, it was not typical for spouses to be included in the treatment. And then he got out of the hospital and, you know, refused any further treatment. I grew up in a beautiful brownstone. My father's practice was for many years in the first floor of our home, sort of like the Huxtables, only not as happy as the Huxtables. And, you know, that was that. I went to Catholic schools, and I'm not one of the people who was abused by Catholic clergy. In fact, I think that my schooling was one of the strengths of my childhood. The nuns that I had in school, you know, cared a great deal for me, and I got a good education. What else do I want to tell you? My mother, yes, she had a college degree in French. She was very artistic, and she, however, became an alcoholic. My mother, you know, was Irish Catholic, so there's a lot of alcoholism in the family history. But shortly after the most severe abuse that I experienced from my father, my mother began to drink even more heavily. And so during my adolescent years, her alcoholism was quite advanced, and she was drunk much of the time. I have an older brother who's 3 years older than I, and a younger sister who's 3 years younger, and a younger brother who was 6 years younger. He passed away, and that's the story of what happened to him is in my memoir as well. My sister, interestingly enough, has written a book also.
Oh, wow.
She's quite creative, yeah. My sister married an African-American man and has two biracial children, and she's written a wonderful book about a workbook for white people who want to deal with race. The name of the book is Talking About Race. I just bring it up because there's so much about racism on the news and the horrible things that are going on in the country. But so fortunately, there were four children, and I say fortunately because we were all in it together, and I'm glad that there are others with me, though I wish that things hadn't happened to them. But that's how I grew up.
So let's talk a little bit about how old you were when you were first molested.
I was about 6 years old when I was first molested by my father. And the sexual abuse went on until I was 17. So that, you know, that's a long period of time.
And how did he groom you? So, you know, because obviously you said one of your goals was, and mm-hmm. you didn't even mean to have the goal, but you broke the silence. You told people what he had done after he had threatened you not to tell. So I'm curious as to how he groomed you for this and, you know, what your thoughts were as a young child.
Mm-hmm. What I heard from my parents and other relatives in their generation was I was a very strong child. I was pretty hardy. And my father spent a lot of time with me. My father was also a pianist. He was a gifted pianist. Mm-hmm. He almost became a concert pianist, in fact. And I sang. And we spent many, many hours at the piano, sometimes even writing songs. So, you know, I think by the way he took an interest in me, he was grooming me. He worked me so that I would have a really strong bond to him. He was very smart and, you know, could manipulate lots of people in lots of different ways. He could be very charming. I don't know what else to say about that, but that's pretty much
well,
how.
Well, did you have that first inclination as a child that what Daddy was doing was wrong, or did it feel normal and natural initially?
I think it was extremely traumatic. I went through my childhood without remembering any of the abuse, any of the sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly remembered my father being on tirades and being emotionally abusive to all of us. I witnessed him being physically abusive at times. to other members of the family. But I am one of the sexual abuse survivors who had repressed memories for many years. And I didn't start remembering the things that he did to me until I was about 40 years old. I had been in therapy myself for 10 years at that time. And there were a constellation of triggering episodes that occurred. I will say that one of the most extreme forms of abuse that he did do to me was to rape me. And he raped me for the first time when I was 10 years old. And my mother was in the hospital with pneumonia. When I was 40, my therapist, whom I had been in therapy with for 10 years, got breast cancer, and she was in the hospital having a mastectomy. And at the same time, both of my parents went into the hospital for different things. They were elderly at this point. My husband and I were overlooking their care. They both went into the hospital at the same time. And then there were other triggering things that are a little more intimate to talk about on the phone, but they are in the book. And I had a flashback of the night that he raped me. When I had that flashback, it made so much sense of so many things to me, because I had remembered sleeping in my mother's bed that night. I had remembered my father being naked, which, by the way, my father would walk around the house naked. So, that's part of the environment that we were living in. He wouldn't do that all the time, but he certainly would feel free to do that at night. So as a child, my feelings toward him were a real mixture. I felt responsible for him in some ways. I felt like I could cheer him up better than anyone else in the family. Of course, being that he was bipolar, he would have mood cycles of being either manic or sometimes depressed. And when he was manic, he would be very cheerful and creative and fun. And when he was depressed, sometimes he would stay in his bed for weeks and never come out, and we would have no explanation for what was going on with him. In fact, my siblings and I at times would have to meet his patients at the door and tell them that he was ill and he wouldn't be in that day. You know, very inappropriate stuff. So there were these extremes going on, and, it was confusing to me as a child. But I worked very hard at keeping him happy, because I always felt that there was a chance that he would kill somebody in the family if I didn't take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was pretty violent. I mean, that bipolar depression really kept the environment unstable.
Yeah, very. And, you know, certainly as part of, I feel part of why my mother drank so much. I mean, I think that there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think that was one of the reasons. But what else did I want to say about that? Just that later, when I started remembering being sexually abused by him, I really developed PTSD, just like the soldiers who come back from war do, and I would have flashbacks of different events of abuse. But it all made sense of why I felt such an amount of responsibility for him as a child and why I was afraid that he would kill somebody if I didn't take care of him. I think in the ways that he abused me, I was really privy to just how dangerous he really was.
So now, tell me, as you were talking about the word, I think you said I had repressed memories.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about these memories. You had inclinations. You had some flashes, but not flashbacks. Repression, as far as you're concerned, is when you do what with memories?
Well, when the memories, when the brain houses the memory in a place that you don't have access to for a while is sort of how I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too frightening to remember and go on. You know, I think it's a child's mechanism for being able to go on in life. And as if nothing's going on, does something really is. You know, it was just too scary to remember. And he had also threatened that he would kill me.
Mm-hmm.
That he would kill me and tell my mother that I committed suicide if I told anyone. So, you know, how in the world can a child, could I as a child, and any child really, in an environment like that, have words for something that is just unspeakable? And
I was going to say, you know, and this is where your therapist comes in, because truly you grew up in such a dysfunctional family that looked normal from the outside looking in,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't really have a bond with either parent at all that had normal boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this therapist that you formed a relationship with was truly your driving force and saving grace in terms of your healing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, you know, what do you think contributed to that relational bond that you had with her?
Well, several things. For one thing, I think that I received good early mothering. I think
mm-hmm.
my early childhood, I had a pretty healthy bond with my mother. I think she was very loving and available and tuned in. And so, you know, I had that early strength inside. My therapist had a stellar reputation. She just had such a good reputation. She was such a fine person, and she was very smart and compassionate. And she was also, you know, so I liked that about her a lot. Helped me to trust her. She was also married herself and had three children. Of course, she was a lot older than I. I don't think I could have trusted and bonded to a therapist who wasn't married and didn't have children, because I was raising four daughters and was married and really wouldn't have thought anybody could understand me if they didn't understand what it was like to have kids.
Right, right.
You know, those are the things. And then on in the therapy, you know, she never violated boundaries. I mention that because that's a big thing, particularly for sex addicts and their families, you know. That's a very important quality for a therapist to have. And she also kept her promises. You know, she was there when she said she'd be there. She, you know, had a really firm structure for the therapy, but was very tuned in to me and really understood me. And that was essential.
Okay, so that's what helped to really form that relational bond, where you felt safe enough to trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
all those crises, in part, set the theme for you to begin to remember the memories.
Yeah. I also,
yeah.
The other thing that set the timing, really, for me to remember the memories, I feel, is the age of my children. They were, you know, going off to college at this point. They were beginning to leave home. And I had sort of a funny dream when I was having these flashbacks and whatnot. And in the dream, Katie Couric comes to me. I'm a soldier out at war, and Katie Couric comes out with a microphone, you know, from the Today program.
Oh,
And she says to me, is it true that you couldn't remember any of these memories until you had raised your own children? And I say, yes, it was very important to raise them.
But that was a gift that was given to you right away, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was, right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, talk about how it was that the molestation stopped at age 17. That's an interesting story, too.
Well, I just got to a point where I wasn't going to take it anymore, you know. I really, one night when my father was trying to abuse me, I, you know, really tried to hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he knew at that point, that was it, I'm raised, and he's not as free as he thought he was.
Well, and you know, that's such an interesting acknowledgement, because I have been working with sexual abuse my entire life, and what I've found is if kids are empowered to say no, even when they're scared, they will likely do it, but they don't know that they can say no, that they can stand up to their abuser, and so that fear of not knowing combined with the threats of them or their loved ones being hurt keeps them caught up in that dark secret. So you decided you were going to risk it, not only for yourself, but, you know, here he was going to kill mom. That was your fear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you had just, enough was enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very, very brave.
There were some other things, too, but, again, there are things that I feel are better to read about than hear on the radio.
Well, I get that.
Another factor, I think, that was part of it was that I also had a boyfriend at that point who is now my husband. And, you know, that certainly, I felt, you know, strengthened by the strength of my friendship with Peter, who is now my husband.
And you've been married how many years?
44.
Mm-hmm. And that is amazing, because obviously you were a young adult / early teenager. And because you were how old when you met Peter?
Peter and I actually grew up together. We were next to each other in the nursery in the hospital. We were born within a couple of days of each other. And we were friends when we were little kids. So I don't really remember not knowing him. But I do remember that we were assigned seats next to each other in the seventh grade after we hadn't seen each other in a while. And what can I say? It was just meant to be. He went home from school that day and told his mother that he was sitting next to the girl he wants to marry.
Mm-hmm. Very intuitive, that, Peter. And, you know, a wonderful, wonderful man. And yet this, you know, significantly impacted your marriage. Sexual abuse always does.
Yes.
Before we get into that, may I ask you, you know, when we talk about betrayal from the abuser, him or herself, there's also that betrayal from the significant other, the parent that's supposed to protect you, your mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So would you describe your relationship a little bit? Because I think there's going to be a lot of listeners that are going to say, yes, my mom reacted the same way too.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because my personal therapy, the first 10 years of it, a lot of it was about my relationship with my mother. You know, I really was so angry at her. And when she would get drunk, I would hate her so much. It was a very, like I said, a strong bond when I was little. But once she started drinking, once she became an alcoholic, I was angry at her most of the time, is how I remember it, because not only was she letting me down, but my younger sister and younger brother were really suffering from not having a sober mother, and It was, my relationship with her was very difficult. In later years, after my parents became elderly and they actually became destitute, and I was overseeing the care of my mother, I was really able to get to a point where I completely forgave her and loved her. And I'll say that even when I hated her as a young person, I also loved her. I loved her as much as I hated her. It was really hard.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, clearly, I think lots of young women feel that way about their mothers to some degree, just in terms of their mothers interfering with their independence or not being emotionally available or whatever. But, you know, in your heart of hearts and with what you went through with your father, your mother knew about the abuse.
That is something I knew, was never sure of.
It was never substantiated, but you wondered that.
Yes, I wondered it, and in a way it was substantiated. I went to see her one night when she was in a nursing home. She was demented. And I went to see her, and when I got there, she was sort of yelling to me, help, help, get somebody to come. The fathers are abusing the daughters, and the daughters are hurt. You know, and she kept saying the fathers are abusing the daughters. And I thought, okay, it's in there somewhere. She might be demented. Somewhere inside her, she knows what happened.
Well, I wondered that. And I also wondered, again, if she wasn't recounting her own life. You know,
yes,
abuse.
I wondered that as well.
I certainly
wondered that as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. However, I would be really surprised if she had been abused by her father, although I never knew him. He died before my parents even married. My mother's family were undertakers. My grandfather was an undertaker. And my mother's side of the family was a shining light in my life. They were very loving and very fun and very respectful and had a real deep sense of reverence for the work that they did and sense of revering the human body as a temple of the Holy Spirit. Even her younger brother, who only died last year, he helped me a lot while I was going through the recovery from the incest. I talked to him about it, and he was very supportive, which was hard for him because it was also painful for him to know that all that went on and et cetera. I can't go into all that was for him, but I would be really surprised if her father abused her. It just wouldn't fit with the dynamics that I witnessed and heard about from her side of the family. They did live adjacent to a cathedral, a Catholic cathedral, and clergy came over a lot to discuss funeral arrangements or, you know, whatever. When they were visiting the sick, they might come by and have a cup of tea with my grandmother and discuss what might be going on. So, of course, I've wondered with all this Catholic sexual abuse scandal, I have wondered at times if a priest might have abused her. But, you know, I have no way of knowing.
Well, you know, it seems like you have very good gut. And for our listeners, I need to remind you that I am talking with Catherine McCall, who wrote a memoir called Never Tell, A True Story of Overcoming a Terrifying Childhood. And She talks about the strength and the recovery that she gained when she was able to accept and deal with it once it came from her unconscious and subconscious into her conscious memory. Now, you talked very candidly about some of the influences of religion and music and education in your memoir. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that? How did you see those things as being coping mechanisms for you?
Mm-hmm. I feel that I got a fine education all the way through school. And growing up Catholic, I could find in the church and the sacraments of the church hope and strength. I started going to daily mass every morning after the first time that I was raped by my father. And, you know, I just, listening to the stories of love and different homilies about how to be, stories of healing, all of that, I'm sure, you know, fed my soul in some very healthy ways. And I went to Catholic school through college, and I was, you know, involved in things a lot. So those things helped strengthen me. Music, you know, I used to joke with my girls, music is the best solution to every problem. You know, I love music. And music was a healthy part of my crazy family. You know, we all loved music. And as, you know, many of you would know, the arts are so powerful in healing people and in giving hope and in giving inspiration, spreading love. So I'm very grateful that music has been such a part of my life. What was the other thing you had said?
Oh, go ahead.
Music, education.
Yeah, religion,
oh, religion.
Music and education.
Yeah, okay.
You know, there are constant themes in your memoir, and you can see that they actually provided for you great strength, especially because, you know, obviously you're dealing with these kinds of issues, but you're also dealing with some of the sexual problems that you struggled with in your marriage. And I know that this is personal, but could you tell our audience a little bit about what those problems were and whether or not you and your husband were able to resolve them?
Yeah. I think, first of all, when the process of me starting to remember things began, I actually had fallen in love with a priest. I didn't have an affair with him, but I fell in love with him. So there was a strong sexual attraction there, which of course impacted our marriage, because that attraction should have been for my husband. You know, was up until then, but at that point it wasn't. Then after a while, my husband developed a sexual dysfunction of premature ejaculation, which is very common. But I go into some detail about it in the book because it's really sort of part of a constellation of things that sort of exquisitely fit together to have launched me into flashbacks and a deep process of needing healing. So he and I got into, I was in individual therapy, we got into marital therapy, we got into sex therapy. He got into a group for survivors, for partners of sexually abused. I mention all that because certainly Patrick Carnes' model for recovery from sexual addiction includes all of those things. I mean, what we did to heal the layers of sexual pain in our relationship was to really be in a comprehensive therapy process. Another thing, two other things that happened in in all of that are that my body, as I went into PTSD and was having flashbacks and whatnot, you know, my body was like a field of landmines. I mean, my husband didn't know when whatever way he would touch me or whatever might evoke a flashback, which was horrible, horrible for me and horrible for him to be doing anything that would feel like a perpetrator to me. That was so, so hard. And the other thing that happened was after a while I developed attraction to women and really wondered, oh, you know, now what, I'm going to find out that I'm a lesbian? You know, I don't know what we're going to go through here. But we, you know, and I laugh, but in a way I don't want to be laughing because I know that really happens to people. And I know that it's very painful and important. But what I can say about all of it is that, yes, I, he, we really did evolve to a place of resolving those things. And we are, you know, very tender with each other. And we really have a lot of empathy for any couples that are going through this. And that is the reason why I chose to put such intimate experience, you know, to reveal that part of the story in the book. Peter and I both feel if our book can help one couple, then... And look, I said our book, our story, if our story, in a way it's our book, can help one couple, it's worth it. Because there are no models in our culture. I mean, you go to the movies, you don't see movies about a married couple where one of them is a sexual abuse survivor. Or in some cases, you know, both are sexual abuse survivors. You don't see how couples really can work through that in a monogamous relationship or in any, you know, marriage. So, you know, that's the story. I guess I want to say to anyone who might be listening, you know, there is hope. It just takes a lot of work, and it takes having competent people in your life who respect you and have a great deal of compassion and smarts.
Well, 100%. And again, Catherine McCall, I'm talking with the author. She wrote Never Tell, A True Story of Overcoming a Terrifying Childhood. And I've got to tell you, we have to wrap up, but you have so much more information. I hope at some point to be able to interview you again. You are a brave and courageous woman. Peter is a courageous man. I want to remind people that if they in any way, shape, or form want to talk with an expert about sexual abuse, about suicide, they can contact 1-800-656-HOPE. And those people are specially trained to help in this situation. And Catherine, it has been a great pleasure to have gotten to interview you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well. Take good care, Carol.
Absolutely. And I'll look forward to talking with
and
you
all
again.
And all of you listeners. Okay.
Thank you.
Good night.
And you know,
bye-bye.
Catherine does. She has a website, and I want to give you that information real quick. It is www.catherinemccall.net, and that is mccall.net, and her email is kathmccall1@gmail.com. So you can contact her in any way, shape, or form that you need to, because as she indicated, if she can just help one person, she's made a difference. So we will see you next week, and as I say at the end of every show, there'll only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly and courageously be yourself. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.